Part 3. Laugh. Chapter 12. Culturing the culture. It takes time and work. To a lot of people, the only culture they experience on a daily basis is to be found in their yogurt at breakfast time. Perhaps this same thought is what inspired Peter Drucker, the internationally acclaimed management consultant and author, when he came up with the brilliantly insightful line, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." In so doing, he nailed what, to my mind, is one of the most underappreciated essentials of modern leadership. No matter how visionary, brilliant, and far-reaching a leader's strategy might be, it can and frequently does all go for naught if it is not fully supported by a healthy and spirited corporate culture. When people ask me what secret sauce has made Virgin a success over the last 40-plus years, the easy answer is my brilliant visionary leadership. I am kidding, of course. The honest answer is 100% down to the people-first culture that we started way back in the last century. We inadvertently created it while lolling around on beanbags in the first ever Virgin record shop in London. The megastores came much later. At the time, the last thing we had on our minds was developing any kind of a corporation, let alone a culture. We were just having a good time, chasing women, and the women were chasing men. We were truly an equal harassment opportunity employer, and figuring out each week if we'd made enough money to pay the rent and the staff. We enjoyed what we were doing. We liked working with each other, and we treated our record-buying customers like they were, well, part of the family. They liked the experience, so they came back for more. And before we knew it, we were on our way. The rest, as they say, is history. I am sure that most people reading that last paragraph are thinking, yeah, if only it were that easy. So I'm sorry if it sounds like an oversimplification, but that is genuinely how we set the Virgin ball in motion. There was also a lot of hard work and plenty of sleepless nights worrying about all kinds of issues, but overall we stuck with it because we were enjoying what we did on any given day. And tomorrow, as Annie would have said, was always a day away. Herbal remedies. Great corporate cultures don't always just come about by chance. They are often an outgrowth of sustained and exemplary leadership, such as at low-cost U.S. carrier Southwest Airlines, with the legendary Herb Kelleher at the helm for the best part of 40 years. Like me, Herb was not a career airline guy. He was a Texas lawyer who saw an opportunity to start an innovative, low-fare airline in his home state that would, he thought, be able to exploit some legal loopholes. He formed Southwest in 1967 as Air Southwest to provide affordable air service within the state of Texas, and immediately flew into a firestorm of opposition from the three existing Texas airlines. It took 3 years of legal battling before the Texas Supreme Court upheld Herb's little airline's right to fly, and he was off to the races. From the beginning, Herb recognized that to survive, let alone succeed, Southwest would have to have more than just low fares. And so, truly a man after my own heart, he unabashedly chose sex appeal as the key. Southwest's happy-go-lucky, fun, and above all else disarmingly attractive and friendly cabin crews became the talk of the industry. Rather like a certain British airline would do a dozen years later by employing exactly the same kind of personalities. But it wasn't just about good looks. With a company motto of hire for attitude, train for skill, Herb always preached a gospel of if we hire and empower the right people who are committed to do as you would be done by levels of consistently excellent customer service, then everything else will naturally follow. Of all the memorable quotes attributed to Herb, there is one that really should be the mantra for any organization. It certainly is for Virgin. He once said, "We tell our people, don't worry about profit. Think about customer service. Profit is a byproduct of good customer service. It's not an end in and of itself." And if the proof of the pudding is in the eating, it is no small coincidence that in January 2012, Southwest became the only airline in the history of a notoriously cyclical business to report an incredible 40th consecutive year of profitability. I have only flown Southwest once on a short flight to Dallas, from where I can't recall, but what I do remember is being struck by how much fun their cabin crew seemed to be having doing their jobs. Other than with the mandatory safety messages, this group was clearly anything but scripted, very much into being themselves and having a lot of fun with their captive audience. A lot of cabin crew attempts at humor come across like they're trying too hard, and so tend to fall flat as a result. Not so here. But they weren't finished yet. When we touched down, it was a bit of a bumpy landing, and over the PA, the lead flight attendant welcomed us with a breezy, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, as you probably felt just there, we just touched down in Dallas." Twice! Stories abound about such things, like the time passengers boarding a Southwest flight were surprised to find the airplane appeared to have no cabin crew on board to greet them. Then, on some cue, the overhead bin doors suddenly sprung open, and in unison the three flight attendants hiding in there all screamed, "Surprise!" This genuinely fun-loving culture has established Southwest as one of the best places to work, and in the process built a powerful bond between employees and customers alike. As in everything about a successful business, establishing a framework in which employees feel truly comfortable expressing themselves requires a leader who is prepared to set the standard and lead by example, and Herb Kelleher, for one, could always be relied upon to speak his mind and be almost crazier than his staff. An example of Herb's ability to exploit every opportunity to sustain the airline's fun culture and generate favorable PR in the process came when Southwest was threatened with a trademark lawsuit in 1992. When Southwest started to use the slogan, "Just plain smart," another smaller company, Stevens Aviation, which had been using the very same tagline for some time, threatened to sue. In a classic Kelleher move, however, rather than going to court to settle the squabble, Herb challenged Stevens's CEO, Kurt Herwald, to a three-round arm wrestling match. The winner would get to keep the slogan, and the loser of each round would give $5,000 to the charity of his choice. The younger Herwald readily took up the challenge, and the much-publicized build-up began. Among other things, Herb put out a video showing his rigorous daily training routine for the upcoming bout, one scene of which involved a single painful-to-watch assisted sit-up, followed by a cigarette and a glass of bourbon. To nobody's surprise, Herb lost all three rounds of the bout, but $15,000 went to charity, and the two CEOs agreed that both companies could use the slogan. So not only was a courtroom confrontation avoided, but everyone ended up a winner. Anyone for wild turkey? My first face-to-face meeting with Herb took place in his hotel suite one afternoon in New York City, while we were both attending an airline investment conference there. I was excited to meet the man, as it had always seemed we were kindred spirits when it came to fun being at the core of running a successful airline, and making sure our customers shared in the experience. Herb was scheduled to be the speaker that evening prior to dinner, and I was to address the group the following morning. The conference organizers, however, had suddenly come up with the idea that it would be fun if I were to give the introduction for Herb that night. As we'd never met, they'd hastily arranged for us to get together that afternoon, and so around 3 o'clock I duly arrived at Herb's suite with a couple of our people. Herb welcomed me at the door with a hug, as if we were old pals, and set about introducing me to his entourage of senior people. We'd barely settled in when there was a knock on the door and room service wheeled in a cart that normally, at least in the UK, might have been expected to have tea and biscuits on it. Not here. All that was on the cart was a bucket of ice, a dozen shot glasses, and a large bottle of Herb's favourite tipple, Wild Turkey Bourbon. Without missing a beat, one of Herb's VPs jumped up and proceeded to pour large shots of Kentucky's famous whiskey for everyone in the room. The only question he asked was, "Y'all want ice?" Certainly a much warmer way to get the party started than, "Anyone for tea? How do you take it?" Over the next hour, as per his reputation, I found Herb to be an amiable bear of a man with a laugh that rattled the windows. With such an obvious thirst for life and bourbon, he reminded me very much of an American Freddie Laker, although Freddie preferred rum and orange juice. We talked about how Herb's earliest vision for Southwest had stayed true to its course while all kinds of other start-up and legacy airlines had come and gone. Avoiding any and all unnecessary complexity is the cornerstone to Herb's business philosophy. For example, whereas in its fleet of over 900 aircraft, American Airlines has 13 different types of airplane, even more now with the US Airways merger, Southwest's fleet of around 600 airplanes consists of just a single aircraft type, the workhorse Boeing 737. This makes every employee's job simpler. Every pilot can fly every aircraft in the fleet, and every engineer knows where every part goes, and that just about every part will fit every airplane. An intimate familiarity with the aircraft means airport ground crews can keep turnaround times to an absolute minimum, which drives higher productivity, and the list continues. They have also avoided getting into relationships, known as interline agreements, with other airlines, which means they control 100% of their own scheduling decisions and don't get blamed for losing other airlines' baggage. If ever there were a business case for the benefits of going it alone, Southwest has to be it. But as important as hardware like airplanes might be, what shone through when listening to Herb that afternoon was how acutely aware he was that it's your people that have the greatest influence on the success or failure of the business, and, as at Virgin, how creating and maintaining a fun, family culture is critical to achieving your targets. Another similarity between Southwest and Virgin is how intensely proud our respective workforces are to be associated with their companies. Or, as a 20-something staff member once said to me, "Hey, Richard, it's really cool to work at a place where it's really cool to work." I must say I found that to be really cool. Anyway, in New York that evening, only slightly buzzed on bourbon, I climbed up to the podium to introduce my new best friend, Herb, to the assembled senior airline executives, bankers, and press. I started out by saying a few highly complimentary things about the man and his airline, and then, assuming a more serious tone, said, "Herb and I met this afternoon, and I was so impressed that I have instructed Virgin's bankers to make a major stock acquisition." As expected, I saw the reporters in the audience suddenly sit up in rapt attention, This was news. Virgin was about to acquire a stake in Southwest. Barely managing to keep my face straight, I continued, "Yes, I told them I wanted to buy 50,000 shares of Wild Turkey stock." Wear laurels, don't rest on them. The flip side of the kind of corporate culture enjoyed at Southwest and Virgin can be found at those dreadful cultural catastrophes where "we" is supplanted by an entrenched us-against-them standoff. Environments where management and labor are on two different sides of a great divide, separated by long-festering quagmires of distrust, bitterness, and malcontent. Such situations can almost always be laid at the door of senior management's prolonged failure to provide strong leadership and/or willingness to change with the times. While the true meaning of the word legacy is quite simply something good, bad, or indifferent that is handed down by a predecessor, when applied to corporate entities, it seems to have become almost exclusively a pejorative. And the sad fact is that a lot of older, set-in-their-ways, laurel-resting businesses tend to share the common denominator of failed or failing cultures, which, like barnacles on the bottom of a boat, impede forward progress to the point of eventually sinking the whole ship. Back in the early retailing days of Virgin, as we began to grow with more stores, a record label, recording studios, and the rest, we never lost sight of serious fun as a driving force behind the business. We carried that same culture, which was and is really just a passion for having fun with what we do while doing it better than the others, into banks, trains, telecoms, and planes, plus a multitude of other very diverse businesses all around the world. As I often say, okay, I say it a lot, a company is nothing more than a group of people, and people are like plants. I'm not sure that I buy into the benefits of talking to plants, but if you water them and tend to them, more listening than talking, in other words, they will grow and flourish. They say, I have always found that one of the simplest ways to monitor the health of your culture is to constantly subject it to the we/they test. In a healthy corporate culture, you will hear employees embracing the first person plural, as in, "Certainly, sir, we can do that for you right away," to describe everything the company does. In an unhealthy culture, the third person plural, they, and its cellmate, them, take center stage, and usually in an arm's length, accusatory fashion, as in, "Sorry, they don't do that even though I've been telling them for ages that the customers would love it." Brett Godfrey summed it up perfectly when describing the difference in, then, Virgin Blue's work environment and that of Qantas, our major competitor in Australia, by saying, "Our people are always in volunteer mode, while over there, certainly if industrial unrest is any indicator, they seem to be in perpetual prisoner mode." One of the many things that makes the Virgin group of companies unusual, dare I say unique, in the corporate world is the hugely disparate range of products and services that carry our brand. We have never been into vertical integration as the primary reason for starting something, albeit that a lot of our ventures have over time started to connect at the edges, like airlines and hotels. A lot of companies make it an overarching policy to stick to their knitting, that is to say, stick with what you know best and don't stray too far from the comfort zone. Not so at Virgin. In many ways, we could in fact be accused of vertical disintegration, given our inability to stick to any particular knitting pattern for too long. Unlike Unilever, General Mills, or Procter & Gamble, we are not a house of brands, But we are a truly branded house. With the exception of our brief foray into the condom business, we paint the Virgin brand onto everything we do. When we start a new venture, we are proud to add our brand to it, in the same way that we do when we rebrand and reinvent a bank or a rail service. The only reason we can do this is because even the most disparate of businesses are not just about bricks and mortar, rolling stock, or airplanes. Sure, those things are important pieces of infrastructure, but it's the people that breathe the life into them. All of our seeming hodgepodge of businesses has one critical element in common: the service culture that comes with our people. Call it the we factor, if you like, is the pulse that drives everything we do. As a result of my work with the Ocean Elders and their ongoing efforts to save the fragile ecosystem of the world's oceans, I have become quite the expert on coral reefs, and it didn't take a lot of dot connecting to draw an analogy between corporate cultures and coral reefs. They both take a long time to grow, and, as many a company has found at their cost, they are a fragile living entity that, if abused, can be destroyed very easily and very quickly. Most established coral reefs are between 5,000 and 10,000 years old, and yet we have managed to kill off 10% of them in our lifetimes. While a corporate culture can be developed a whole lot faster than coral, when either one is destroyed, the chances are that they're gone forever. Cultural destruction. David Hoare, the co-founder of Talisman Management, has been a friend and associate of mine for many years, during which time he has worked as a chairman, CEO, and advisor to a wide range of underperforming companies. Sorry, I take that back. What I intended to say is that he has taken on the challenge of fixing a wide range of underperforming companies, which is Talisman's specialty. David comes from an intriguing engineering private equity background, but he is also a genuine disciple of the invaluable people equity that a healthy culture brings into play. David explained to me one day his concerns on the way the standard private equity model is supposed to work. This is the one where you take a leading company in a growth market with a strong management team, add some financial leverage, and a generous dollop of management incentives, which are of course tied to ambitious financial targets, and hey presto, value creation. But what happens when the results fall short of expectations? That's when the new owners stamp their feet, change the CEO, and set even more ambitious targets, the assumption being that the next one will do a better job. Sadly, this often doesn't work either, and the company's value continues to be destroyed. David can reel off a long list of companies where he has seen this storyline playing itself out. Starting in 2006, parcel delivery service CityLink had four CEOs in 5 years who jointly erased £1 billion of value. At the DX Group, an express mail service, it was five CEOs in 4 years and £450 million. And waste management company Biffa lost a staggering £1.2 billion under six different CEOs in just 5 years. The obvious question is how such disastrous collapses in value can possibly happen in companies that had been leaders in their market areas. As David sees it, in every one of these cases, the senior teams were incentivized into marching the company to the drumbeat of totally unrealistic financial targets. Doing the right thing in the long-term interests of the business was pushed to one side, and as a result, a lot more than value was destroyed. One of the key components that had made the business successful in the first place, the corporate culture, was another, more tragic victim of the destruction. And while changing CEOs may be easy, restoring a badly damaged culture is never a simple task. As with any trust-based relationship, making up is hard to do. For startups, too, the ability to develop the kind of healthy, people-focused culture that is so critical to a company's sustainability is seriously impeded if, from day one, the primary focus is on short-term gains and rapid, force-fed growth. I am always alarmed when I hear startup leaders talking more about fulfilling their investors' exit strategy than about creating a great product around great and happy people. In many such cases, the exit may well arrive involuntarily and much sooner than the strategy ever foresaw. Had we failed to recognize in time that Virgin's short-lived experience as a public company was going to extinguish the culture that had made us what we were, we might not have been around today to talk about it. Thankfully, we'll never know. I must apologize if I am starting to sound like the proverbial broken record jamming iPod on this, but let me quote Herb Kelleher's successor at Southwest, who could easily have been channeling Herb or myself, when he said, "Everything begins and ends with our people. If we keep our employees happy and engaged, they will keep our customers happy, who will then reward us with their loyalty. That repeat business helps our bottom line and creates value for our shareholders." So too at every Virgin company, none of which could survive without the dedication, energy, wit, and wisdom of our incredible family of people. In simple terms, in their blind stampede to deliver superior economic results, too many business owners and leaders fail to understand enough about the importance of carefully developing a company's culture. When Peter Drucker said, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast," he might have added that when there's too much focus on profits and growth and too little attention to nurturing your people and culturing the culture, there's a very serious risk that somebody else might soon be eating your lunch.